President Bush claims the Iraq elections are a victory for democracy. You clearly disagree. Why?
Elections, in some circumstances, can be an important component of democratization processes, but the notion that every election under any conditions somehow isn't a legitimate instrument of democracy is simply foolish. An election that is held under a hostile foreign military occupation, an election held when the country is ruled by a puppet government put in place by the occupying powers, an election to be run by, at least officially, that puppet government, an election held when the war is raging so violently that not only will people not be able to get to the polling places, but even the international election monitors, who are ostensibly there to determine whether it's free and fair, will not even enter the country because it's so dangerous. Elections under those conditions simply cannot be legitimate.
Is it possible at this point to have a genuine democratic election in Iraq, or would any election be a sham under these circumstances, and what circumstances would have to change?
I don't think there can be an election under these circumstances. It might be possible in some areas to do some kind of polling. For example, the notion of the United Nations running a referendum similar to what they did in East Timor, to ask the Iraqi people whether they want the U.S. occupation to continue or not. That might be a possibility. I think that would be very difficult to pull off as well. But certainly this election, where the goal is not simply to express an opinion, but to actually choose an assembly whose framework was established by the U.S. and its puppet government, an assembly whose job it will then be to determine the constitution, ostensibly of a future Iraq, this is simply nonsense. The U.S. has admitted that 4 of the 18 provinces are too dangerous to hold anything resembling a reasonable election. What they don't emphasize is the fact that those 4 provinces hold somewhere between 40% and 50% of the entire Iraqi population. And that's admitted by the U.S. The reality may be even far worse than that.
Now, is there much doubt regarding the outcome? Like, who's likely to quote unquote win? Who are the people who are going to form the interim government at the end of this process?
Well, I don't think we know exactly. The common wisdom is the Shia will win. And it's certainly true that even in those areas where it will be possible to have some people vote, Shia are by far the majority of the population, probably somewhere between 60% and 65% of the population across Iraq. That doesn't tell us much, though, about which parties people will vote for. There are 2 coalitions of Shia-dominated parties, one that is dominated by the religious parties and others unofficially endorsed and understood to be backed by the Grand Ayatollah Ali Sistani, who's the most highly respected Shia religious figure in Iraq. The other are secular parties, mostly dominated by the U.S.-backed exiles, people like Iyad Alawi, the current prime minister, is a leading candidate on one of those parties. On the other hand, there's a lot of overlapping. Ahmad Chalabi, for a long time the Pentagon's guy in Iraq, is running, I think he's number 10 on the list, of Sistani's list. So it's a very mixed bag. And one of the big problems is Iraqis don't even know who's running on most of these lists because the vast majority of candidates will not make their name public because it's simply too dangerous. So we don't really know who the parties are. That's going to make it very difficult for people to make judgments. The assumption by the U.S., and what we're hearing so much in the U.S. press, is that the Shia will vote for Shia parties, without taking into account, number one, that Iraq traditionally has been a very secular country, that people's identity is far stronger on the national level. They identify first as Iraqis and only secondarily as Sunni, Shia, or even Kurd, but also that people have different interests. You know, I would say that an Iraqi Sunni farmer has far more in common with an Iraqi Shia farmer and far more interest in who is going to be the Minister of Agriculture than either one of them have it necessarily in supporting the Shia or Sunni defined party.
This raises a question, though. I've heard some speculation that the Shia parties as loosely defined, or certainly, so there could, for example, be a number of people elected who firmly believe in a timeline for immediate or something close to immediate withdrawal. But what power will this government actually have to or order that or demand that?
Well, that remains a big question. The U.S. official position all along has been, we will leave as soon as the Iraqi government asks us to. But the reality is far different. The reality is, number one, I'm not convinced that even those parties who have made some kind of commitment to asking for a U.S. withdrawal, or at least a date certain to be set for withdrawal, are in fact going to press for that if they get elected. Anyone who's elected under this U.S.-backed process is as likely as not to be concerned about keeping U.S. troops there, because it's the only thing that will keep them in power. And I think that that level of kind of political opportunism of the traditional sort is as powerful today in Iraq among those candidates who might win as anywhere else in the world. Significantly, I think there's also the possibility that the U.S. will simply, even if such a request were made, that the U.S. will simply find a way to ignore it. Today's U.S. press focused on announcements of the Pentagon yesterday that they are planning on keeping more or less the same number of troops, which is about 150,000 U.S. troops, in Iraq through 2006. Now, that doesn't seem to take into account what the Iraqi population might want. U.S. plans for Iraq are not based on what Iraqis want. So the notion that somehow after this election we're going to see our government doing what Iraqis want because Iraqis want it, I think is rather naive.
Mitch does raise the question about why the White House administration is so adamant about pushing ahead with this election. It seems to be not only, I mean, clearly unpopular with insurgent forces, but also even members of the Iraqi interim government have expressed concern about holding elections. Now, there seems to be reticence there. Why is the U.S. administration so gung-ho and determined to push forward with this?
Because the rationale for these elections has very little to do with what Iraqis want. It has far more to do with providing international and particularly U.S. domestic credibility. If you recall, all of the earlier rationales for this war, weapons of mass destruction, Saddam Hussein is connected to September 11, there are links between Osama bin Laden and Iraq, all of those have been proved to be fake. All of those have been proved to be lies. The only one that they're now relying on to justify this invasion and occupation is, we did it for democracy. We did it to overthrow a dictatorship and liberate the Iraqi people. Liberate, liberate, liberate. We're going to liberate them until they're dead if we need to. We're going to liberate them so much. To justify that, they need to show something that looks like democracy. And to Americans, who tend to be not very sophisticated in our understanding of democracy, democracy looks like elections. So if we have something that looks like an election, I think the Bush administration is hoping that Americans will start to believe that this is democracy because they had an election. You know, it becomes a cyclical thing, and I think they're hoping that this will alleviate some of the growing opposition, which is growing to the point where now 52% of Americans say explicitly that the war was not worth the human or financial price. Increasingly, the mandate that George Bush is claiming to have as a result of this election is proving to be false.
I wanted to ask a couple questions about this transition that the Bush administration is this transition to democracy the Bush administration is very gung-ho about. It does seem to be very key to their overall domestic political strategy. I guess my first question is, since the beginning of this so-called transition period, we've in fact seen on virtually every level that it has failed. The violence has increased. There are more attacks, more deaths. Ironically, even less participants in the coalition of the willing, so-labeled. Is that what effect is that having on domestically for Bush?
Well, so far, unfortunately, it has not had a huge impact. Although I think it's part of the overall erosion of support for this war. As you say, the first so-called transition, which was the transition from the acknowledged U.S. occupation of Iraq to the denied occupation replaced by the imposition of a puppet government known as the Iraqi Interim Government, which happened last June. We were promised at that point, we will no longer be viewed as an occupying force. There will therefore be a diminution of violence. Well, the problem was that all sounded very nice, but Iraqis live there, unlike Americans. They see what's going on the ground. They see that the U.S. occupation had not changed, and that the U.S. was still in control, and they still didn't have safety and security on the streets. They still didn't have clean water. They still didn't have safe schools. They still didn't have electricity. Gasoline remained in short supply, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So with those conditions, it was not surprising that the escalation of violence spiked very sharply. Over the long haul, and, you know, if we look at the last 6 months, say, since that June so-called transition, we've seen, with the escalation of violence in Iraq, an escalation of opposition here in the United States. We are seeing hints of a backbone emerging within the Democratic Party. You did have Barbara Boxer and Ted Kennedy and others in the last couple of days challenging Condoleezza Rice in her nomination hearings to become the new Secretary of State, all focused on Iraq. You do have 16 members of the House of Representatives drafting a letter which comes very close to saying, bring the U.S. troops home now. It says, start the process of determining when the troops are going to come home. That would not have happened 6 months ago. So we are seeing an erosion of opposition, a rise in opposition to this war. And now the question is how to speed that up.
Now, why specifically do you think the resistance in Iraq is increasing as these democratic opportunities are appearing?
Well, again, I don't think Iraqis believe that this is a democratic opportunity. Even many Shia political actors of various sorts are starting to say, this is crazy. We're going to win this election, but it's going to be a Pyrrhic victory because there will be no legitimacy to it. So why should we participate in it? The resistance is growing because the conditions of occupation are getting worse. The illusions that the U.S. is trying to impose on Iraqis are increasingly resented, illusions that this election is somehow going to be free and fair. And what's so unfortunate is that the casualty rise, it is rising among U.S. troops, but far more significantly, the major rise in casualties is among Iraqi civilians, who are generally not the targets, but the victims of this fighting. We see an increase in attacks not only on U.S. troops, who are increasingly protected, but against Iraqis who, most of the time, not out of choice but out of desperation, lack of a job, lack of other alternatives, Iraqis who are working with the U.S. occupation forces, training as police, training as military, working as translators, working as cooks, whatever. And despite the fact that they are most often driven to those decisions by the lack of other alternatives, they are seen as collaborating with the U.S. occupation and therefore fair game. What is unfortunate is that within the resistance, which is a very wide-ranging and diverse set of political and religious and social forces, within that resistance, there is a hardcore who I think are not only opposed to the U.S. occupation, but are opposed to any sort of modernization, are opposed to secularism, are opposed to a range of things that Iraqis traditionally have wanted. You know, they've wanted democracy in a real sense. They've wanted equality. They've wanted secularism. And there's a hardcore that includes many non-Iraqis and some Iraqis who are motivated more by a kind of extreme Islamism, who are conducting some of the worst attacks on civilians. That hardcore, I think, will continue. But after the occupation ends, that hardcore will no longer be surrounded by this much wider, broader, and more focused resistance whose target is the U.S. occupation. That's what's allowing the resistance to grow. It has this combination of forces within it, and as the U.S. consolidates its occupation, that resistance is only going to continue to grow.
Would you go as far to say, in fact, the occupation has in fact achieved opposite of what one of its initial goals was in fact, this is supposedly the masterstroke in Bush's war on terror, And in fact, it has allowed Iraq to become in some ways a breeding ground for extremism and religious extremism in particular.
Well, that's absolutely true. Somebody like Peter Bergen, who's one of the top U.S. experts, top world expert on terrorism around the world, has said that the U.S. occupation and invasion of Iraq has given to specifically Al-Qaeda and terrorist organizations aligned with it a gift far better than anything they've ever received before. The invasion of an oil-rich Arab country, the occupation by secular Christian forces who are identified as crusaders, the rise of a resistance movement with a clear target, which is now supported by people all over the world who don't necessarily want to choose military resistance, but see that as the only thing standing in the way of a further expansion of that occupation. So it's been a huge gift to those forces who were once quite small and isolated and now are operating, according to the State Department, in 60 different countries. We now have the Iraqi intelligence officials themselves saying, those backed by the U.S. occupation forces, acknowledging that the Iraqi resistance is now made up of something like 40,000 active military forces and 200,000 supporters and non-military support units. That's a huge resistance in a country the size of Iraq. And that comes just months after a U.S. estimate that there were somewhere between 5,000 and 6,000 members of the Iraqi resistance. The British said that, well, that's ridiculous. It's much bigger than that. It's probably close to 50,000. But now we hear it's 240,000. So this is something that was very much the creation of the U.S. invasion and occupation.
At this point, I'm almost out of time, but I did just want to quickly ask, do you see coherent, a lot of talk we have about Iraq, it's sort of, we use the term resistance, but as you've already noted, there is in fact not one coherent resistance movement, there are many. Do you see coherent or leadership or leaderships emerging within Iraq, and how could those groups actually at some point move forward and form a coherent nation out of Iraq?
I think it's going to be a very difficult task. As you say, the resistance is multifaceted and they have many different views. There are different levels of leadership. The Shia leader Ali Sistani has essentially endorsed these elections and in fact urged that they be held early, which is part of the reason for this January 30th date. One of the other Shia leaders, Muqtada al-Sadr, who was leading the armed resistance in Najaf not too long ago, has since that time been very quiet and kind of tacitly standing back and allowing the elections to go forward, but now is saying, in the last couple of days, his forces have reemerged saying, we don't support these elections, essentially challenging Sistani's role. And that's just within the religious Shia community. There are whole other parts of the Iraqi civil society that involve secular forces, both Sunni and Shia, the Kurds with very different views, tactical alliances between the U.S. and the Kurdish parties, but on the other hand, Kurdish civil society saying, no, we actually want independence, something that their political leaders had given up some time ago. So there's a huge range of political opinions, not surprising in a country where the expression of political opinion was suppressed for many years. It's going to be very difficult. But the only thing I think we can say for sure is that the presence of the U.S. occupation troops in Iraq is the problem, not the solution, both to violence and to the challenge facing Iraqis in creating their own government. This is something Iraqis have to do for themselves. It's not going to be easy. It's not going to be fast. It's not going to be pretty. But this is not something that the U.S. can impose at the barrel of a gun.
Thanks very much, Phyllis.